Welcome back to Stack Trace, a show where we talk about Apple news from a developer's perspective. And as always, it's me, Guy Rambo, with my dear friend, John Sandel.
Hello, how's it going, Guy?
I'm doing great. What have you been doing lately, John?
So I've been exploring a new kind of realm the last couple of months, or the last 2 months. I've started a newsletter. This is something that's super exciting for me. It's like trying out something new and trying out the new format. So I've been running my website now for about 1.5 years. And I thought, let's try to do something new. So a lot of people have been asking me to provide like email notifications whenever a new article gets published. But I thought, let's do a little fun twist on this and create like a little newsletter. But not just have like a list of links in a newsletter, but to do like the newsletter is almost like a mini article or something like that. You've read it, so I guess you can tell me what you think about it.
Oh, I love it. I like that it's short and goes straight to the point. So there's a little intro, which is very nice. And the content is great. I love the curation that you're doing. And yeah, I'm enjoying it.
That's awesome. Yeah, so I wanted to be like a list of links of all the kind of articles and stuff that I've been writing, and also just some links to other things around the community. Like this last edition was about some of the videos from NS Spain and Swift and Fika, which I attended, these two conferences. And yeah, just throwing in some bonus content in there as well. So this has been a lot of fun for me to do. But I have to say, I now appreciate the people who do newsletters in our community a lot more. I mean, I always appreciated them, don't get me wrong. I think they're doing an amazing job, and there's so many great newsletters out there. And also, my goal with my newsletter is definitely not to create one of those kind of newsletters. There are already so many good newsletters that are about like what's going on in the community. My newsletter is more like just a kind of summary of the stuff I'm doing. But I definitely like now appreciate more what goes into creating a newsletter, because let me tell you, creating a newsletter is a lot of work, even if you're only focusing on your own content. I mean, let alone creating a newsletter that sums up everything from the community. That's just an insane amount of work.
Yeah, I have that feeling sometimes when I'm writing something for 9 to 5. You have to take sometimes a large concept or many different information sources and condense that into a single unit of work that can convey the information to people who don't know about it yet.
Right, yeah.
It's hard.
It is really hard. Yeah, it sure is. And kind of summarizing your own thing is way easier than summarizing someone else's thing, right? Because you want to do it kind of justice, and you don't want to, you know, if you take a 30-minute talk or like a long article and you want to sum it down into a couple of sentences, you want to, you know, really pick those sentences very carefully.
Nice.
So besides that, I've also worked a little bit more on my editor that I'm working on, the Swift editor. It's still kind of a prototype that's ongoing.
Best editor.
Yeah, hopefully. The latest thing that I've been exploring is a feature that I call Smart Autocomplete. Ooh. And it's kind of like, you know how you will have a protocol, right? And you will call the protocol operation, for example. And then you implement a class called Async Operation. Now the editor sees that and it sees, oh, you just defined a class that is called something something operation and you have a protocol call operation. Well, let me suggest to you that you will conform to this protocol. And so you can just tab and it will automatically conform to that protocol. And when it does, it also fills in all the methods that are part of that protocol for you. So that way, I feel like you can stay a lot more productive when you're doing like protocol-oriented programming, which a lot of people are doing in Swift. Having some fun with that stuff, like just keeping exploring like different features that I wish kind of Xcode or other editors had, and see what would it take to implement some of those.
Shut up and take my money.
Yeah, maybe one day, we'll see. And on our latest after show, we actually did something really cool, I think. We actually built a very lightweight version of this editor. Like we built basically the first iteration of the editor, which was using syntax highlighting. It could build and run the code. And yeah, it had like a nice UI and stuff like that. So that was on the latest after show. So if you missed that, make sure to go to our Patreon or just go to stacktracepodcast.fm/aftershow and you can become a member to watch the video from that after show, because I think it turned out really nice. And you also get all the sample code so you can play around with it yourself.
Yeah, that's very nice. And I got the code, and we talked during the after show about making the code debuggable when you actually build and run.
Yeah.
And I have some info on that.
Okay, tell me.
I've been working on that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Nice.
So I haven't done too much yet, but I have an Xcode app project that I can build and run, and it will launch LLDB attached to a process, and it has like a little terminal window that you can interact with the debugger. So
wow, yeah. That's awesome.
That was easier than I thought it would be.
That should be like the subtitle of this entire project for me, I think, which is, you know, all these things, it sounds insanely complex, right? It sounds almost impossible, like building your own editor with a debugger with that can run code that has autocomplete. It just sounds like an impossible task. But once you start looking into it, because so much of the tool chain when it comes to iOS development and Mac development is open source, and it's on the command line. So you can just call it on the command line.
Yeah, I had to do some things that are different for me, like some system calls to open a TTY and connect it to my file handle and stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
Which is new for me, but yeah, it's not very hard at all.
You're learning, right? That's the fun part.
Of course. Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, awesome. So what have you been up to apart from also getting into editor development? We're going to turn into editor developers, it feels like. But what have you been up to?
Yeah, it's an editor pandemic.
Yeah.
So I did something different this week. I helped a person that I know get his first app in the App Store.
Wow, that's great. That's really cool.
Yeah, so my colleague, he's a junior iOS developer. He started with us last year without knowing anything about iOS development or Swift. He came from a different team in the company. And so he has been working with us, and he does Swift development and some OPC here and there, but he prefers Swift, of course.
Of course.
And he is studying computer science, and for his computer science course, he decided he would make an app and release it in the App Store. And so he showed me his project, and I helped him set up the project to be able to submit to the App Store, and how to do the icon and the screenshots, and how to reply to the encryption questions and stuff.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I'm very happy to say that his app is now live in the App Store.
That's awesome. Cool. What kind of app is it?
He made an app for the people in his college to share rides with each other when they are going home after school.
Oh, nice. So it's like a little mini Uber or mini ride-sharing service.
Yeah, kind of like the feature they added to Waze now, but specifically focused on his school. So it's a very nice app. I'm not going to share the link because it's specific to the public that he made it for. So
sure,
our public doesn't need to use the app. But yeah, I'm very happy for him, and I'm very proud as well.
That's very cool. Yeah, because there's so many things that you learn that goes into getting an app on the App Store that is not about coding, right? Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I was going to submit an app to the App Store, and I had finished coding, and I was like, okay, let me just get this on the store now. And I thought, that's going to take like an hour, right? But then you have to learn about all these things, and it usually takes like a long time. So I'm sure he was very grateful for having you there to kind of guide him along.
Yeah, and it was funny because I was all the time saying, oh, don't feel bad if you get rejected. It's normal. You're always going to get rejected on the first time. And he got approved on the first submission.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, it definitely used to be like that. Like back in the day, back in the good old days, or I don't know if they were so good, but it was definitely true what you're saying. Like, I remember I was working with some clients back in like, I don't know, 2009 or 10 or something like that. And we were basically telling them, like, you know, the time you want to be on the App Store, we should start submitting like 2 months before that or three months before that, because otherwise you might risk missing your deadline.
Yeah, and I don't know if how new this is, because I haven't like released a brand new app in the App Store, and I don't know if they do this only for brand new apps or if it's your first app, but they sent him a very nice email like, oh, congratulations, your app is now in the App Store. And yeah, I find it very nice. We didn't have that back when I submitted my first app.
Yeah, everything is just so much nicer now.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's jump into our main topics. And we're going to start with a bit of an exclusive, right?
Ooh.
Stacktrace exclusive. So Rambo, you found some interesting things in, you've been spelunking again, of course, you know, it would be a surprise if you didn't. And you found a really interesting new thing in the iOS 12.1 beta regarding how Apple might be implementing some form of suggestions regarding notifications. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I talked about how I was done with spelunking for this year, but of course I was not. And it's hard to stop. I need to go to spelunking rehab or something. But yeah, I've been doing some spelunking on the 12.1 betas. Some cool stuff has come out of that, some iPad stuff. And yesterday I noticed that they added a new implementation for notification suggestions. It seems to be related to the system learning about how relevant some notifications are for the user or are not relevant to the user, and promoting or demoting notifications based on this score that they will give your notification. And it looks like there are two different implementations of this. One of them is a more heuristics-based one, so just like some rules and algorithms to calculate a score. But there's a new one that's definitely new in 12.1 beta 2, which uses CoreML. So it uses machine learning to study your habits with regards to notifications. And to probably, I haven't seen this in the UI. A friend of the show, Vitici, he said that he got some suggestion from Siri to disable notifications.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that yet, but so apparently they are going to be using this knowledge and this machine learning model to maybe if you there's an app that sends you notifications and you never open them, you always just clear them, it's going to suggest, hey, maybe you want to turn this off.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems like a really cool feature, because one thing that we can see Apple doing a lot, and that's not only for notifications, it's kind of across the whole operating system and their own apps as well, is trying to reduce like the noise for users, right? Because a lot of users, including, you know, myself and probably everyone, you know, we sign up to a lot of stuff because we might be interested in one thing. And I think I mentioned earlier on the show, which was, you know, you are taking a flight with a certain airline, you install their app and you want to enable notifications because you want to see gate changes, but then they start sending you all these marketing messages, you know? And it's similar for a lot of different things. And one thing that I also saw in the UI was in the podcast app, Apple's official podcast app. Now, I don't use that one. I use Overcast, but I am still subscribed to this show and to Swift by Sundell in the official podcast app just to be able to see kind of how the show notes render and these kind of things. And when I logged into the, or when I opened the podcast app recently, it showed me a notification which was, you haven't been listening to the show for a while, do you want to unsubscribe to it?
Yeah.
And yeah, that was along those same lines, which is, you know, I guess Apple realizes that people subscribe to a lot of different things and it's not always that you want to keep doing that. And if the system can be smart enough to start suggesting these things, you can just get an overall nicer experience and just reduce the noise in general.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, there are two different implementations, it seems. One of them is just an algorithm, and the other one, the brand new one, is using machine learning. John, do you think you can explain to our listeners what would be the difference between an algorithm and a machine learning based model?
Sure, absolutely. So usually, or the kind of old school way of doing these kind of things is based on heuristics. Like you said, like you basically implement an algorithm that contains code for deciding something. So in this case, deciding what score to give a notification. So you would have different rules in there to say, you know, if this happens, then increase the score. For example, if the user interacts with a notification, then increase the score. If the user hasn't seen or hasn't interacted with the notification in 2 days, decrease the score, etc.
Yeah, so just as an example, this model for notifications, it has one method that is probably using the heuristics-based approach, which has app popularity, total launches, number of notifications received, number of notifications ignored, number of notifications the user has cleared, the number of notifications the user has engaged with, how many actions the notification offers, if the app has shortcuts in the springboard. I don't know why they use that, but they do. And number of taps, and also a bias for the app. So those are all inputs to this algorithm.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think the shortcuts one might be because if your app has a shortcut that is often in the today view or something like that, you might be less likely to click on a notification for that app, for example, right? So they might be using that as an offset so that you don't punish apps that implement shortcuts because that Apple wouldn't want that, would they? Yeah. So that would be like the algorithmic approach, which is, you know, very, very common. And the way most of these things have been implemented up until like the last couple of years, I would say. Because now machine learning is the big, cool new thing. And with machine learning, what you instead do is that you give a machine learning program, you basically build a model by giving it a bunch of training data. So that could be, in this case, all the kind of analytics or signals for notifications for a group of users. So this is the notifications that these users got. This is how they interacted with them. And you don't define the rules. You don't say this is good, this is bad. You just give those as signals and then you train your model based on that. So you say, here is, for example, an example of a user that is very highly engaged with his app. And you give this data to the algorithm. And then you say, here is an example of a user that is not highly engaged with this app. And you do that, but you have like thousands and thousands of examples. And then you train the model on that. And then eventually the machine learning algorithm or the machine learning program kind of comes up with its own internal rules. That's of course a huge simplification, but it kind of comes up with these heuristics kind of internally using a neural network or something like that to figure these things out. Would that be a good way of explaining it?
Yeah, I think it is. The interesting aspect of this is since they have two different implementations, what they might be doing, and you came up with this idea, and there are two possibilities, and they are kind of similar, actually. They could be A-B testing, so they are using both approaches randomly, selecting like, oh, 50% of users are going to have the suggestions based on algorithm, and the other will get the suggestions based on machine learning and will compare the results. So that's a possibility. And the other one is they are using the heuristics approach to train their model. Yeah. So they analyze the actions taken by the user, and then they use that as input for the machine learning model. With regards to A-B testing, I think it's worth mentioning. Many people have the idea that Apple is not one of those companies that does A-B testing, but they do. I don't have any practical example in mind right now, but I have seen implementations for A-B testing on iOS. They do A-B testing, but it's a lot less common than companies such as Facebook, Google, which they basically drive all of their decisions on A-B testing. That's not what Apple does, but they do A-B testing from time to time. And it's also worth mentioning that it makes sense that they are adopting more machine learning now that they can run, first of all, on the device with CoreML, And considering how much faster the neural engine is on newer devices, so maybe another possibility is that they are using the heuristics approach for old devices, so before the this year's devices, and using the machine learning one for the new devices because they have performance for that.
Yeah, that's a very likely thing, I think. Machine learning is obviously a very, very important part of software engineering right now, and it's probably just going to keep growing. So it makes sense that Apple, they want to really get really good at this. And the only way to do that really is just like keep implementing it and keep working on it and finding new use cases for it. And it might also be like a almost like a battery saving, or maybe not battery saving, but performance saving thing, where if they can offload a lot of these tasks to the neural engine, well, that just frees up the CPU, right? Or the GPU, I guess, in this case, which is the most common thing to use for machine learning. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and the new neural engines can do lots of operations.
Oh yeah, it's crazy. What was it, like 6 trillion operations per second or something?
Just something like that.
A crazy amount. And regards to A-B testing, I definitely agree with you. I think that Apple, they're probably doing more A-B testing than what we might think. And I think just like when people think about A-B testing, sometimes you might just think that it's like testing two completely different features or two completely different implementations of a UI. And yeah, sure, Apple, they don't do that, right? Because they show the UI as part of the OS, like in WWDC, and then it ships in the fall. So that is a very kind of non-A-B testing approach. It's like, here's the UI, we're going to ship that, here we go, you know? But for things like this, like under the hood, I'm sure they do a lot of A-B testing, especially when it comes to algorithms and fine-tuning them. And now we should think like machine learning, and definitely just to, because we're talking about such a huge amount of data that you need to analyze.
Yeah, and they are using differential privacy for this, so they can probably collect anonymous information and aggregate information to learn about how users are interacting with the new features and the differences that happen when they use one approach or the other.
Yeah, so really exciting to see Apple using machine learning in this field, and I'm curious to see what's going to be the end result of all of this.
Yeah, me too. And I love when they dog food stuff, because the stuff they dog food is usually the stuff that turns out better in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so next up, we want to do a little quick segment just predicting what the new iPads might look like, because the chances are pretty high if we are going to believe that the device identifier is called iPad Fall, right? iPad Fall 2018. So the chances are pretty high that we're going to see new iPads this fall. But what exactly will they have? Like, what kind of features will they have? What will they look like? And things like that. So, Rambo, why don't you kick this off? Like, what are your kind of biggest kind of broad stroke predictions for the new iPads?
So these new iPads will have an edge-to-edge display, not as edge-to-edge as the iPhone, but it will be significant. It will not have a notch. It will have Face ID. The Face ID camera is probably going to be positioned at the top, just like it is on iPhone. It's going to support Face ID in any orientation except upside down. It's also going to feature a new type of smart keyboard adapted to the new style of iPad. And it's probably going to feature at least one USB-C port.
Ooh, that last part there is really interesting. What makes you say that?
Stuff.
Best reason. Okay. seeing USB-C on iPad, I think would be really, really cool. And I really like USB-C. I think we've talked about it before. I think it's kind of coming to fruition, the whole USB-C lifestyle thing, but it's going very, very, very slowly. And I think if iOS could get in there and, you know, push the wagon a little bit, that would make a huge difference. So if we would get the iPad with USB-C, maybe even the iPhone, maybe next year with USB-C, that would be huge.
You see, I believe an iPad with USB-C, especially an iPad Pro with USB-C, does not necessarily mean a move to USB-C all over iOS devices. I see this as a move towards the iPad not being such a bigger iPhone type of device that many people feel it is at the moment. So This fits in with the "what's a computer" narrative. Maybe the new iPad Pro will have USB-C, but it doesn't mean that all iOS devices are getting USB-C. Maybe it's because it's a Pro machine, and maybe it's because they want people to be able to connect external hard drives to it, or 4K displays, or something like that.
Yeah, you could definitely see a demo on stage with like Adobe or someone building like Hollywood style software, you know, or image editing, things like that, to be like, oh, you know, we used the new iPad Pro, we deployed it, and here's it connected to four 4K displays or something, you know, because these devices now, especially with, because presumably the new iPad will have the A12X, right? The new chip, the new high power, high clock speed version of the new iPhone chip. And these chips are very, very fast. So I wouldn't be surprised if you could do something crazy like connect like two or three or four 4K displays to it.
Isn't the iPhone XS faster in single core than the iMac Pro or something like that?
Something like that. I think it was the JavaScript benchmark that was faster.
Yeah.
Which is single threaded.
Yeah, so that's mind-blowing, and it shows how Apple is advancing with their chips. I think the two things that have been commenting the most lately, now that the new iPhones came out, the two aspects are cameras and processing power.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those are fascinating.
Yeah, and having the iPad be more of a kind of, you know, hybrid device, not in that it's a hybrid device like Microsoft's devices where it's like kind of a laptop, kind of a tablet, but more it can become like a desktop computer. Like imagine if you could connect a mouse to it. I know I've talked about this before because this is honestly my biggest dream is that you can have this completely transformative device that can be anything. And if you could connect an iPad Pro to an external display, for example, that could be extremely powerful because the UI on the iPad and like the full touchscreen is really great for a lot of different tasks. Like I could see myself like doing podcast editing on a device like that with like a big screen. Yeah, and you can move things around, or video editing, which I don't do, but you know, if I did and things like that, you know, like basically editing and media production could be really, really powerful on a device like that.
Yeah, and there's another StackTrace exclusive here. I found a new property on iOS 12.1. The property is called, and I want you to help me figure out what it means.
Okay.
Count of keyboards requiring all smart cover HES disengaged for open.
Now that's an Objective-C method if I ever saw one.
Yeah. So just to get this out of the way, HES means Hall Effect Sensor. So if people don't know, that's like a magnetic sensor. So that's the sensor the iPad uses to detect when the smart cover is closed. And but why do they need to know the number of keyboards? More than one keyboard? What does that mean?
If we think about it, let's play along with this USB-C kind of thread, you know? So let's say we have USB-C, let's say we have Bluetooth, and let's say we have a smart connector. That means that we can potentially connect three keyboards at the same time. Right?
It's going to be like me on my new Twitter header.
Exactly.
They drew for me where I am typing on two keyboards at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be double-threaded Rambo. That's what it's going to be. So, I mean, that could be the method because if we think about it, the OS probably needs to do a lot of adjustments regarding if an external keyboard is connected or not because it doesn't show the software keyboard. There's probably like some events to be hooked up when it comes to keyboard shortcuts and things like that. So that could make sense, right? Like if you, because right now the OS probably checks, do you have a Bluetooth keyboard and that maybe goes through some like Bluetooth controller and, or do you have a smart connector? But now if there's going to be like a third one, maybe they like abstracted that out into its own API.
Yeah. There's one aspect as well that you may be working with your iPad Pro in a quote unquote clamshell mode.
Right.
So you like connect it to a display and a keyboard and you use it, I don't know. So it's a very interesting name. Maybe it's just a weird name and that's it. But I found it funny and I wanted to share it with you.
Yeah, it's really cool. I'm thinking like if you would use it in that kind of mode, you would need some kind of input device. So I'm not expecting mouse
like a
support.
Puck?
Yeah, like the...
You see, there's another thing. I only mentioned this on Twitter and more in a joking way, but they added to Backboard. So Backboard is the thing on iOS that handles touch input and delivering inputs to different processes. And they added, I think it was on one of the iOS 12 betas. So it has different types of inputs it handles. So it has like a hand, so for palm rejection stuff, finger, and other types of inputs. And they added one called puck.
Oh,
What's a puck?
What's a puck? That could be the next what's a computer. Like the next
app. It's not just what Syracuse calls the Apple TV.
Oh, right. Yeah. The Apple TV is an input device for an iPad. That would be funny.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something like, you know, how the Microsoft Surface Studio, it has this like dial, right, that you can attach to the screen and you can kind of turn it in order to control the UI. Maybe Apple, they're inventing something like that, but maybe you put it on your desk and it's almost like a trackball. But I don't know. Now I'm really just thinking out loud here. But, you know, something like that, that could be cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. But you could see that as a hidden name for a mouse. I guess some mouses do look like pucks.
Yeah, especially the old ones, right? Wasn't there like one of the one of those infamous mice that Apple designed that was like a puck that was no one liked to use or something like that?
Yeah, for some people, for me, I like the Magic Mouse. I don't see any problem with it. I know many people totally hate it.
Oh,
so
I
for
love
many
it.
People, Apple has never been able to make a decent mouse.
All right, yeah, exactly.
And I would agree with that until the Mighty Mouse. So the Mighty Mouse was also not very good.
Oh, but the Mighty Mouse was really cool. I really liked the Mighty Mouse.
Yeah, yeah. And you remember that the little lights below it, if you shined it to the wall or something, it formed like the little face of a mouse.
Yeah, that's so Apple.
So cute.
Yeah.
The Mighty Mouse was terrible as well, but the Magic Mouse for me, it's fine. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to think about this. Maybe... I don't know, you can pair a Magic Mouse with your iPad and use the cursor? Why not?
Yeah, why not? I mean, I would be completely in favor of that. I think that would really be a huge boost for the iPad because then the iPad could be used pretty much like a computer. And I know people already are using it that way to perform computery tasks, but now I'm just talking about the input here. If we could use like a keyboard and a mouse, well, that would really start to blur the lines between a Mac and an iPad. And considering that Marzipan is on the horizon, and presumably UIKit has needed to be updated for all these events anyway, you know, why not bring it back to the iPad, right? But
yeah,
the big question, I guess, would be third-party support, and could you really translate touch events directly to mouse events? Maybe. I mean, it works decently in the simulator, right?
The answer is yes, you can.
Yeah.
Because I made a Marzipan version of Chibi Studio and I didn't have to change anything in the touch handling code. Like in the editor, and some things got better with mouse input, like in the editor where you can select different items on your Chibi. Using the mouse is a lot better because if you're trying to select, let's say, the eyes of the Chibi, with your finger, sometimes your finger can cover the entire face of your chibi. So it's very hard to actually select the eyes or the mouth or some accessory on the face. And with the mouse, it's perfect. It's super easy.
Rambo, have you made your touch targets big enough? Are you following the human interface guidelines? Are there really 44 points?
Oh, that's actually... It works fantastically well
with a mouse.
With the finger. It works better than you'd expect with your finger. Like it tries to figure out the stuff that's right in the middle of the touch target. So yeah, it works fairly well with the finger, but the mouse is more precise, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I think you could definitely do a one-to-one translation between single touch events and a mouse input, like a click. But I guess also since the Magic Mouse also has gestures, right? It has like a touch area on top. You could also do multi-touch on it as well. So yeah, the sky's the limit.
There's also the Magic Trackpad. So they with the Magic Trackpad, you can do pinch to zoom, you can do rotation and everything.
Yeah. One thing that could be a problem or just something they would have to solve, which again, I think they need to solve for Marzipan anyway, is focus, right? Where if you, when you're touching on things, you can just touch anywhere on the screen, especially if you use two apps side by side. But if you are using like keyboard input or something, you would need some kind of, you know, concept of focus, which I guess some iOS apps already have, but maybe it needs to be promoted more to like a system level.
Or maybe they're going to release a 27-inch display with a 4K or 5K and a touch input. Who knows?
That would be amazing. That would be
super
cool.
It would be the pro event.
Oh yeah, exactly. That would be the iPad Max.
Yeah, maybe that's the tattoo display that Steve Troughton Smith found.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, and just before we move on to the next topic, I also found yesterday, as we are recording, that they have been adding some stuff to the everything that has to do with the TrueDepth camera system to figure out when the camera is covered by something like your hand. Something that can happen if you hold the device in landscape mode and you're holding it on its side.
Right. And you think they'll use that to like display some kind of UI to show you that you need to, well, move your hand?
Yeah, it was there on iOS 12.1 Beta 1, but they removed it on iOS 12.1 Beta 2. The Face ID thing, and I interpreted the code and ran it on my head to to figure out what it would do.
The Ramble compiler.
You know the little circle that shows up on when you're unlocking the device, for instance, or when you're authenticating with Face ID?
Yeah.
It would like shoot out and like pulse to the, like, that's what I got from reading the code. So there was a little UI feedback that, hey, you are covering the TrueDepth camera system.
Huh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
And for any emoji, you can try this out if you're running the 12.1 beta on an iPhone 10 or 10S or one of those. If you open up the Animoji app on iMessage and you cover the TrueDepth sensor, it's going to show up a little message saying camera covered.
Oh, okay. Well, that's super useful because with Face ID, one thing that I think it kind of needs to improve a little bit is kind of the feedback as to why something is not working, right? Because it could probably tell, like in this case, it can tell that you are covering the camera, but it could also be, you know, we were talking about maybe the new iPads will support Face ID sideways, but not upside down. So if you're holding it upside down, maybe it can even tell you that, like, please rotate the device or something
like
that.
Yeah, that's another one that I found, actually. It will actually say to you, rotate your iPad.
Cool. Because the one thing that you don't want with Face ID is for people not to trust it, right? You want it to be very predictable. And for the most part, I think it is. I think it works really, really great. But there are those times when it just refuses to recognize you and you don't really know why. And most of the time is because, you know, you're using your phone in bed or something and it's maybe rotated the wrong way or too far away or something like that. And it would be great if the phone could give you like more granular feedback so you could kind of act on that.
Yeah, and in fact, the system does know a lot about what's causing Face ID not to work. It even can detect like if there's a flare on the camera, if the sun is right behind you, if there's too little light, if there's too much light, if the camera's covered, if the device is too hot, or if only your face is only partially visible. It knows a lot of things about what's not working. So I guess they will give you more feedback. And with iPad, it's more important because you can be holding it in landscape on its side. So the top and bottom become the sides. And it's possible for the palm of your hand to be covering the camera slightly.
Yeah, and especially when people just get this device, they're going to keep using it the way they've always used the iPad. And for some people, that means holding it in the spot where the camera is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So kind of educating these people and these users to say, you know, you're holding it wrong. You're literally holding it wrong.
It would be so funny if when they implement that, the feedback would be Steve Jobs saying, you're holding it wrong. I don't know if they have a recording of him saying that.
Yeah, I'm sure they would do that. That sounds like something that would pass, the user testing.
Yeah, of course, definitely.
Awesome. So yeah, really exciting. I am looking forward to seeing these new iPads. It feels like one of those years where it could be a big leap and there's a lot of things in the works and it could be like a transformative kind of year for iPad, but we only know some bits and pieces here and there, and hopefully, you know, we would see like more of these things than not just like, oh, now the iPad has what the iPhone has, but to see more of these things like we speculated about, like with USB-C or being able to connect displays or something like that. I think that would really make the iPad so much more powerful.
Yeah, the things I am 99% sure about are that the new iPad Pro is not going to have a notch, and that Face ID is going to work in both orientations. The yeah. USB-C thing, 90%.
Ooh, so high. Okay.
A little less.
Well, hopefully we're going to also get around to playing some poker about this, so we'll see
Ooh.
What's going to happen.
Oh no, now I said too much.
Now you've revealed your hand, yeah. All right, next up we want to talk about a little bit of a different topic. We want to talk about open source, because open source is something that both of us have been working with quite a lot, and I think almost every single developer who works on either iOS or another platform is either using open source directly, maybe contributing to it, or at least uses something that in turn uses open source, because the fact of the matter is that open source is everywhere. And even if you're not a developer, if you're using any kind of product, there's a huge likelihood that there will be some form of open source component used in that product. So open source is incredibly important for the entire industry. And we have some thoughts on open source.
So John, since this is such a programmery topic, I think you could help us and help our listeners who are not developers. We're still trying to keep them as listeners.
Yeah.
So explain quickly, what is open source? What does it mean for a project to be open source, for a software to be open source? And as we discuss this topic, I'm going to ask you to explain some of the concepts involved, just so we can keep our non-developer audience.
Sure, absolutely. I'm happy to be the chief, what does Casey call it on ATP? Chief summarizer in chief,
or chief explainer.
There you go, chief explainer in chief, that'll be me. All right, so open source software is basically software that is available with the source code open, right? So not only can you use this program for free, you can also see the source code. And usually you can also contribute to it, which means that you can make modifications to the source code and even send it back to the original project and say, hey, I made this change, which can be like a bug fix or a new feature, and it can get integrated into the main project. Now, what's important to also note is that open source does not always mean that you can use the software however you want. Because open source just means that the source code itself is available so you can read it. There's still a lot of different licenses that people use for different projects that give you different kind of permissions and different responsibilities. So some licenses, like for example the MIT license, is very, very generous in what you can do with it. But some are more restrictive in what you can do and what you are required to do as a user as well. But in general, open source means the source code itself is freely available and you can read it, download it, and use it.
Yeah, as an example, my WWDC app for macOS is an open source project. It's the biggest one I have, and it means that my app is with a BSD license, so it means anyone can copy the code for free, can use it commercially, it's a very open license.
Yeah.
It only requires that first I'm not liable for the software, and also that if the person does use my code, they have to acknowledge the copyright that I have over the code. But that's it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's available. The code is open. Anyone can download the code, read the code, modify it, share it, and optionally contribute to the app. And the app is only in the stage it is right now because I have many people who have been contributing to the app, because I would not be able to do it by myself right now. So that's with that out of the way. What's been happening recently with both of us, and I think it was you who started it more seriously, and then I followed, is we are disabling issues on our projects on GitHub, because we use GitHub to share our open source stuff, and it has this feature called issues. So, John, what are issues?
Issues is many different things. You can use it to facilitate discussions. You can use it to report bugs. You can use it to keep track of ongoing tasks and things like that. But in general, it's like a little tab on each project on GitHub where you can start new threads. Like, you can create an issue and then people can comment on it. You can put sample code in there. You can link it to other issues. You can add labels and things like that. So you can kind of use a little bit like a project management system, but the way most people interact with it, I would say, at least as users of an open source project, is filing bugs, asking for support, and asking for new features. So if you need a new feature from an open source project, it's very common to open an issue and say, hey, thanks for the great project, but can it please do this as well?
Yes. So as an example, my project has 25 open issues. So open means they haven't been dealt with yet. So they haven't been fixed or implemented or finished. And it has 253 closed issues. So an example is subtitles are not in sync with video if playback speed is not 1x. That's one of the issues. So it's clearly a bug or something. And there's another one that is a feature request from someone who wants 1.1x speed for video playback. And there are many other issues. So usually with open source projects, the issues are there's some bug or there's some use case that's not contemplated by the current implementation and the person wants that. And that's usually what issues are.
Another very common class of issue is support and questions. So you get something like, hi, how do I do this using this library or using this app? Or have you thought about this? Or how does this project compare to this other project? Those are all very kind of common questions to get on an open source project as well.
Yeah, and there's a big difference between the types of issues you get when the project is an app and when the project is actually a library. So the library would be like a piece of code that by itself can't be like run. It's not like an app, but it's just a piece of code that others can use to do something like connect with the Amazon Web Services. That would be like a library that you adopt on your own project. There's one that I use on my app, which I made myself, but is a separate project, which is called Chromecast Core, and it's an implementation of the Chromecast protocol for macOS. Mm-hmm. So the app can play to Chromecast devices. So that's like a library. It's not something that can be used by itself, but it can be used to improve other projects. And the types of issues you get on apps or libraries are very different, usually. So libraries get more of the stuff you mentioned, like, how do I do this? How do I do that? Can I use this instead of this other library? What's the advantage of using this instead of the other thing?
Yeah.
Sometimes use cases, I would love if it did X, but it only does Y.
Right, exactly. So let's get to kind of the core of this discussion. So like you mentioned, Rambo, we've both started disabling these issues. So we've started looking into turning them off for various reasons. So I could start with just my kind of reasoning and my background as to why I'm starting to do this. So far, I've only disabled issues on one of my projects, which is Splash, which is my syntax highlighter. And it was kind of done as an experiment to see what the effect would be and how I would kind of work around not having these issues. Because obviously by closing the issues or by disabling them, you lose kind of a channel of communication with the users of the project or with other contributors. So it was very important for me to make sure that that wasn't lost, that there's still other ways to communicate. And that other way is, by and large, right now for me with Splash, pull requests. So that would be when someone wants to make a change to this project, they will implement the code and then they will send you this code as what's called a pull request. And the pull request actually behaves a lot like an issue in that you can write a description for it, you can have discussions on it, you can link it to other pull requests, you can put images and animated GIFs in there, you know, whatever floats your boat. So with Splash, my experiment was, what if I disable issues and instead only use pull requests? And the reason I wanted to do this was I wanted to try to move to a model where the people using this library or this project was feeling more of a kind of ownership over the project. So rather than using the project, you know, just go to the GitHub page, clone the project and start using it, I wanted people to more like familiarize themselves with the code so that if they encounter a bug or if they want a new feature, not only will they just ask for it, but they will implement either a full solution for it or a partial one to start the discussion. So that when an issue is filed, for example, a bug, that could be accompanied in this case with a test. So you could say, I found this bug and here's a pull request with a test that actually reproduces the bug so we can start talking about how to fix it. And so far this experiment, I must say, is going really well. I'm really liking the outcome of it. And it seems that the people who have started contributing and are, you know, interacting with this project are happy with it as well. So I'm not 100% sure yet, you know, I can't declare success, but so far so good. And I'm definitely feeling a lot more motivated to work on this project because it creates this much, much nicer relationship with the users than when using issues, I think.
Yeah, so my approach was very similar, but I've been a little more aggressive, actually. I have lots of open source projects on GitHub. I have more than I thought I had yesterday when I was actually going through the process of disabling issues for most of them. I have many, many projects. And GitHub now has this other concept of archived projects.
Right,
so
yeah.
If a project is not relevant anymore, so you just want to keep it up for historical purposes, but you don't want to actually have any contributions or change anything anymore, you can archive a project so it stays available, but it's read-only, basically.
Yeah.
And I've done that for many of my projects. There's one which I would like to mention, which I commented with you yesterday. Which was a Finder Sira UI.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was a funny one.
this was when people were speculating about what the new design for macOS would be after Mavericks. If you remember, after Mavericks came Yosemite. And it changed the design of macOS a lot. And people were speculating what it would look like. And the code name for it was Sira. So many designers made concepts. And I remember I saw one of those concepts and I found it interesting. So I implemented a little plugin that would be loaded by Finder and would turn it into, make it look like the concept the designer had made.
Uh-huh.
And that was a fun project. So that was one of the projects I archived because
right.
Why would you want that?
Yeah.
Another one was an implementation of a window on macOS that would have a translucent title bar. And this was pre-Yosemite as well.
Ooh, so ahead of your time.
I remember I was like we were like competing, me and a friend of mine. He works at Apple today. We were like sending emails back and forth because Slack didn't exist or we didn't know about it back then. We were sending emails back and forth. Hey, I managed to do this translucent title bar, but the scrolling performance is terrible. Can you do better? And then I went and hacked a different way of doing it. The way I solved it back then was by actually making the title bar be a separate window and using a little quartz call that made the background of the window translucent with a blur. And ooh, that was nice. A lot more performant than doing with a car animation.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a nice hack. So yeah, many like hacky and old projects that were not relevant anymore, I just archived those. But then there are other projects such as my Animoji Studio, which you can go to github.com/inside GUI/Animoji Studio.
And we'll put link in the show notes.
You're going to see that it's actually called **Studio because reasons. So this is a project that is currently in development. I update it from time to time. I did a Memoji for iOS 12 and it broke on 12.1, so I have to fix that. This is a project that, like, it's just a fun thing. It can be useful for people. Famous James Veitch, the comedian, he uses the app for his show, I guess.
Yeah, that's super
even,
cool.
Yeah, even made like some features, and he actually downloaded Xcode to install the app because, of course, it can't be available in the App Store because it uses private APIs.
Yeah.
So this is a project that I don't want to be bothered by it.
Right.
So I don't want to get bug reports. I don't want to get feature requests. I don't want to get questions of people asking how to build it. I don't want to be bothered by it because it's just a little hack that I made for myself. And it's out there. It's open. If you want to use it, fine. You can use it. It's a BSD license as well. But I just don't want to give support to it, basically. And even though it's not implicit when it's not explicit when you put an open source project out there that you're going to give support to it, people feel like it's an implicit thing that they can expect you to fix issues answer questions about your open source project. But for me, at least, that's not always the case. Like, one project that I am willing to answer questions and receive bug reports and receive feature requests is my WWDC app.
Yeah.
So that, for that one, I have issues enabled and I have people working with me and helping me with triaging issues and answering issues. So I'm not alone and that helps a lot. But Animoji Studio is just a hack. It's just a little fun thing for me on the side. So I don't want any support questions or any bug reports or anything to do with it. But I still would like for the code to be out there and for people to get access to it. So that's why I decided to disable issues on that project.
Yeah, I think you hit on a really good point there, which is there's a lot of kind of common misconceptions, I would say, about open source, which is, well, the one thing that you kind of hit on there is that if you open source something, that means that there's some kind of support contract involved, right? Which means that if I'm a user of an open source project, I can go and say, this is not working, and kind of expect that it should be fixed. And I can see where this is all coming from, right? Because usually when you have an open source project, you will, you know, you will write a nice README and you will say, well, this project is awesome and it's so cool and you're excited about it. And that can be interpreted as I should use it, right? And if you start using something and then you encounter an issue, you probably want some help, right? So I totally see where this is all coming from. And I don't feel as strongly maybe as you do, which is like, I don't want to be bothered. I can understand why you feel like this way about an Animoji Studio or asterisk Studio, because like you say, it's a fun hobby project. But
yeah, and there's another aspect that it's not a project for developers,
right?
Which is what open source projects usually are.
Yeah.
So I had many like people who are not developers and they don't know how open source works at all. opening GitHub accounts just to open issues
right,
on the
exactly.
project. So I didn't want to handle that.
Yeah, so that makes total sense. For me, it's more about trying to find a nice way to kind of manage all of those things. Where that's why I would splash what I mentioned. I started just promoting a pull request based workflow, and I clearly describe in the README that that's the case. There's a contribution guide where you can see, you know, how do we submit a pull request to this project? What is kind of expected of you when you do so, and things like that. There's some automation in place to run the tests and all those kind of things. But I'm trying to find ways to kind of trying to meet the users kind of a little bit more halfway, where it's like, just like you say, I'm super happy to put my code out there for free so people can use it with very few strings attached, right? So you can use the projects, you can use the code in many different ways. You can use it in an app, you can use it to learn from it, you can build your own solution on top of this one, you can just use parts of the code base. There's so many different possibilities, right? And I'm super happy about all those things. But the one part where I always need to find a way to do in a reasonable way is this support thing, right? Because as a single person, it's kind of really hard to support a lot of people having questions and a lot of people wanting new things from a project. And then sure, you could say, well, why don't you kind of scale it up, right? That's the number one thing you hear people talk when they talk about open source is scale it up, right? Just, you know, get more people involved, get more contributors, get more people helping out with issues. And yes, absolutely, you could do that. But that means that you're making this project a lot bigger. You're kind of all of a sudden managing some kind of team. And it all depends on kind of what your goals are. So if your goal is to build like a big, big open source project, right? Like a huge one that is used in so many different apps and so many different use cases, and it has so many different users, then yeah, that's probably what you need to do. You can't take on all of that yourself. But for me, that's not really my goal. My goal is to share the code because I'm happy to do so, and it seems like a lot of people are learning from it and enjoying it, and that's great. Like, then I'm really, really happy. But my goal is not really to build like the next big open source project. I don't know if that's what I want to do. It's more like I would like it to be on a reasonable level, that it's not too taking up too much of my time, but still giving people value, right? So trying to find like a nice balance there. And that's sort of why I'm moving towards this more pull request based workflow and disabling issues, where I'm saying, if you want to use this project, that's awesome, you know, have fun, here you go, enjoy it. But if you want to have some form of support from me and you want me to implement new features or something like that, you're going to have to meet me a little bit halfway, right? So you're going to have to do part of the work, maybe creating a test to reproduce the bug or starting an implementation of a new feature, and then I can help out and then we can build it together. And for me, that feels like a much more healthy approach, because that way, like I mentioned earlier, people feel like a bigger ownership and they feel more part of the project rather than it just being like a product that they're using. And when this product breaks, they're calling the customer support, right?
Yeah, I totally get it. And I think it makes sense. And it doesn't work for every project. There are some projects which are like libraries that are used by many, even big companies out there that have many maintainers and 20,000 stars on GitHub. So those are the types of projects which probably really need issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
But for our little side projects, I think we can get by without them. The only big project I have, which is the WWDC app, I am keeping issues. I think they are still important there. But I think if you are doing open source, or if you thought about doing open source but gave up because people would open issues, you can just throw your code out there. And another thing I like about having so many open source things is that I can use them for teaching. Like sometimes I'm in a Slack group and someone asks a question, oh, how do I do something with the button class on macOS that makes it do this? And I remember, oh, I have that on my WWDC app. I can just link the person to the file and they can read it and learn from it. So that's another aspect I like about having my code out there. Like today I was in a Slack group and someone asked, how do you usually do view models? And I just sent a link to my milkshaker sample project on GitHub, which I made for my talk on Siri shortcuts, which has view models in a way that I usually do them. So I send them the link.
That's perfect. Yeah, and totally. That's the thing. Like, I think in order to be able to use open source in a more kind of, you know, in different kind of ways, we need to start breaking down some of these assumptions, which is, number one, that all open source projects are built to be these like super general purpose libraries or frameworks, and their goal is to become super big and everyone is using them. Because like you mentioned, and like I mentioned, those are not really our goals, right? We might just put something out there for teaching or for showing an example or just for fun, for just starting some conversations around it or experiments, showing some ideas. And all of these things, I think, have a lot of value. And I wouldn't want anyone to be discouraged from doing open source because they feel like it's this big responsibility. As long as you're clear with it in like the README and you're saying like, you know, this project works this way, and if you are going to use it, here are some things to keep in mind. For example, you know, there's no support, or there is support, but through pull requests, or however you want to set it up. But I definitely think that there needs to be a lot of flexibility in terms of how you want to set up your own project. And I would also encourage everyone who's listening to this show that if you are a user of open source, to kind of also think about these things, that try to make the life for maintainers nice, you know, try to be nice when you're opening a pull request, and, you know, make sure to try to do as much as you can to make the maintenance of these projects easy, because it kind of is a win-win situation where if you're, for example, opening an issue on a project, you probably want some kind of help or you want that to be addressed somehow. Just like in your day-to-day work, when you're working, if someone comes with an issue or a bug report that is incomplete and it doesn't have much information, it's really hard to act on it. So I think it's important to kind of be good citizens from all kind of perspectives, as a maintainer, as a user, reporting bugs, whatever it is, however you're interacting with these projects, to try to do it in as a nice way as possible.
Yeah, and try to follow if the project has like a template for issues. My project does, and they usually list like a list of questions you should answer before opening the issue. And we've done that to like filter the issues, because we used to get many issues that were like, it doesn't work.
Right, yeah.
Something like that. And what do you mean it doesn't work? Does it crash? Does it hang? Does it not do something? Is a feature that's broken? Also, always have a look at previous issues, especially the closed ones. You can use the search feature on GitHub on issues to search for issues which have a specific word or phrase. Because many times people will request a feature, and it's something that we don't want to implement, and it's something we don't want in the app. Like, it would be nice if this app made coffee for me or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And no, we are sorry, we don't want the app to make coffee. We just want it to play WWDC videos.
Right.
And then we close the issue because it's not an issue anymore. But then a year later, someone else opens another issue. Hey, can this app please make coffee? And we have to say, oh, we're sorry, we already answered this before. We don't want the app to make coffee. So always look at closed issues to see if the stuff you're trying to report hasn't been dealt with before.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where this experiment goes. And, you know, just to clarify, I think both of us, like, it's not that we're saying that every project should disable issues. Definitely
yeah,
not.
Course.
And also, it's not that we don't want to answer questions or something like that, because both of us, like, I don't know about you, Rambo, but I'm probably answering like something like 100 or 200 questions every week from people around the community. So I love to answer questions. This is part of what I love what we do. You know, the reason that I love so much like being a part of this community and sharing things with people, it's interacting with other developers, you know, talking to people, not only answering questions, but just having great discussions with people online. And that includes things like GitHub. So it's not that we don't want that. It's just that we're trying to experiment with this format and with open source to try to find like a nice way to deal with it and a nice way for us to be able to do more of it, like to do more open source and to not feel discouraged whenever we have something cool that we want to share, to not feel like, oh, maybe I shouldn't because it's going to come with all this extra work that I have to do, right? That's kind of the goal here.
Yeah, as always with everything we do, we need to try and make the things we do sustainable, and so we can do more of it and then do it well. So it has to be sustainable, and same goes for open source projects.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're now reaching the end of this episode. So if you want to find out more about the show, you can head over to stacktracepodcast.fm. You can find us on Patreon if you want to help support this show, maybe help support our open source work, you know, support all the things that we do. You can head over to patreon.com/stacktracepod. And you can also find me on Twitter. I am at John Sundell, and Mr. Rambo, he is @_inside. So that's all, and thank you so much for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you on the next episode. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.